What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it.
Hey, Asia.
Kim.
What's up?
Not much. I've got my matcha, I've got my bar, and we're gonna record something today.
That's awesome. I feel like we've seen a lot of each other this week.
Yeah.
We've been spending a lot of time together.
I know, almost every day now.
Yeah, we've had a lot of things going on, but all fun.
Yeah.
So what are we gonna talk about today?
Yeah. Okay, so there is this concept that I've been noodling on for probably years, but it's especially been true in the last few months. And it's this concept of whenever we work with founders, specifically bootstrap founders who are struggling with growth, what we find is there's this common phenomenon where it's almost like the base assumption is that whatever the problem or the challenge isn't figure outable. Or maybe it is figure outable, but there's no clear process to figure it out. So for example, activation, it feels like a black box to a lot of founders who struggle with activation. Like the conversion rates are low, the net user retention rates are low, but there is a process and a way to figure that out, like how to solve it.
So what are they saying?
It almost feels like abstract, but I get that feeling because whenever I chat with a founder, and sometimes we might not actually be working with them. Sometimes it'll just be like in conversation. They'll be talking about maybe their challenges with growth, and there almost is like a passiveness or like an acceptance of, well, everyone struggles with this, which means it probably isn't solvable or no one's figured this out.
And so then are they doing nothing, or are they just sort of complaining and lamenting and saying, well, yeah, we have an activation problem. Oh, well, everyone does.
It's a little bit of both. And I think what I tend to hear the most is, you know, oh, well, all of my other founder friends are also struggling with this, which means it's normalized. But I've also heard like, we know that this is a problem, but we don't know how to solve it. We don't know that it is solvable. And it's just easier for me to not like pay attention to it, which is understandable. Like if you're a technical founder, especially, I find this is true. Like you're more comfortable with product and engineering and like some of the technical challenges that come up, but maybe less so with more growth or marketing or sales, for example.
Right. So it almost seems like, okay, this feels too big. I don't know where to start.
Or
is that it?
That, or like, it's so unclear to me what the path is that I almost don't know that there is a path. Like it's almost like there's like a cognitive dissonance, it feels like. And I see this again the most in the bootstrapped and indie funded communities where, and I'm not going to say, you know, VC hasn't mastered. I think the difference with VC is that they're just able to hire people who are experienced, who already know how to do the thing. But when it comes to bootstrapped and indie founders, you really have to figure out how to do it on your own, or at least leverage or stand on the shoulders of other giants. But my, I guess, flag that I want to fly and what we're going to, you know, unpack today is, it doesn't matter what the challenge is in your business. Someone else has figured it out. And also, like, not just figured it out, but like killed it. Someone has slayed whatever thing you're struggling with. And it doesn't matter if it's activation, if it's retention, if it's expansion, pricing, like whatever your problem is, acquisition. I mean, we spend the most time, I think, talking about acquisition. Founders tend to be the most obsessed with marketing, for example, because it feels the most mysterious. It's the one thing in the business that does not have like a direct feedback loop next to maybe product. I think product can be a little elusive sometimes, but marketing is especially mysterious because, you know, it's not just like, you know, put a dollar in, get $2 out. There's a lot that goes into it, but it doesn't matter what it is that you're struggling with. bad UX, like it, like whatever the problem is, someone else has figured it out, and like a million times over, someone else has figured it out and like killed it.
So are these founders not finding those people that killed it?
I have a couple of theories, and it reminds me of this tweet back when we were on Twitter. That's gonna be my joke for forever. There was this tweet from Heaton Shaw, and this was around the COVID years. And this was like 2020, 2021. And he said something that was like, I just feel like as a sector, we've lost so much progress because there's just a lot of knowledge that was there. There was a lot of like business knowledge and founder knowledge that kind of like just didn't get preserved well enough and distributed well enough. And therefore, a lot of people are reinventing the wheel, or they feel like they're reinventing the wheel. And so they look at a problem like activation or pricing or retention, and they look at it like, oh, no one has ever figured this out, or like, this is a new problem, which is fundamentally untrue, because SaaS and software have been around for decades. And we've seen the unicorns and now the decacorns, but we've also seen very successful bootstrap small indie funded companies as well, and you know, highly profitable companies like Basecamp and now Kit, previously ConvertKit, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But and that quote resonated so much with me, that what Heaton was saying was, because I agree, I feel like there was a shift in the tech sector where I think we got like a very large influx of new founders, not realizing that there's like a whole library of things to learn about how to build a business. And we started to get terminology around a lot of the things that we're doing, such as like PLG. We've been doing PLG technically for decades, but we didn't have a word for it until I think in the last like 10 years, I guess. And I'm sure that there are some like old heads in the SaaS world who are like, and before it was PLG, we called it something else, kind of like ABM, like account-based marketing. Back in the day, it was just called enterprise marketing. Like that's what it was called. So it wouldn't shock me if PLG had like some predecessor that it was just called something else. But when I think about that, it's almost like, yeah, like we lost like a fabric of knowledge almost. And so now founders are entering into the space, and not only do they have like a ton to learn, which definitely feels insurmountable, very unwieldy, but at the same exact time, there are so many sources of knowledge and expertise, and it, like I said, like it doesn't matter what problem you're trying to solve, someone else has done it before, and so really, I think the thinking that we have to shift, and this is what I would love to shift for founders, is the thinking that we have to shift is ultimately that, oh, I have this problem. Who else has fixed it, and how did they fix it?
Right. So this is solvable, and I just need to find out how. So how do they do that? Where do they look?
Yeah, where do they look? Yeah, how? So the place that I have always started is I look for books, actually. Books are, I think, one of the best resources out there. And I think I like books so much because they're actually very well packaged, just little tomes of knowledge for, especially for executives, CEOs, and leaders who just don't have time to take a course.
Yep.
Books are where I start usually. And also, I mean, I'll look for articles, but I guess my qualm with engines like Google is that Google will obviously prioritize, you know, the highest domain rating, the most backlinked site. And what I find is that the best thinkers on solving these problems probably aren't ranking super high in the search. So I try to find, honestly, consultants who I think are really good at this. So for example, I learned activation from Samuel Hulick and Ramley John. Like that's who I learned it from. And Ramley has a book, Sam has a website. And I just remember learning tons and tons and tons about activation, just those through those two resources alone. And then I think my next place is actually courses. Although I don't recommend this to founders specifically unless they do just really enjoy. Some people love a course. I love a course. Like, I'm unabashedly a lover of a course and will absolutely buy them and not do anything with them. Like, I'm like the worst offender of this.
I have seen this.
Yes, you've observed this in Demand Maven history. But when I'm really excited about a topic and I'm like, because I get motivated by learning new things and then executing them like in real life. Like, that's what motivates me. So a course to me is just like a gateway drug. Like, I'm like, ooh, I get to learn something and then do it. And that's exciting for me. But that's not exciting for a lot of founders who feel like they don't have time, or that's just not energizing to them.
Right. It's time consuming. And you have to a lot of times go at that pace if you're watching videos, as opposed to skimming through a book, trying to pull out what you need.
Totally. And then I think, you know, there are lots of experts who have courses. So Wes Bush created the PLG course. I don't think Remley has a course on onboarding, but I know that there's another expert on growth, at least. His name is Andrew Kaplan, and he had a course. He had a couple of courses actually on growth. He doesn't sell them anymore. But I distinctly remember being like, hell yeah, like this is awesome. So I will go through a course in a heartbeat.
Because I do think there's different types of people, right? So you're probably someone that can read a book, go do a course, and you know, maybe intuitively, I can pull that little nugget and this little nugget, and that's how I'm going to pull that together to solve my problem.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm a little like that, but like, I do feel like some people too are like, very process oriented. If they're trying to pull a resource, right, and find like, give me these steps or give me something a little bit more with the process. So I'm curious, how do you balance that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I get trying to solve, like, there's playbooks. Well, there's books out there, but it's not always a playbook, right?
Yeah. This is kind of where we get into, what is it, the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you like, you scratch the surface on a topic and then you're just like, oh, I'm the expert now. But actually there's like this whole, this is how I feel about jobs to be done, actually. Like, most people, you know, they attend one talk from Bob and then they're like, I understand jobs.
Yes, we see it. And they say, oh, we ran jobs with our customers. And then we're like, oh, great. And then we realize, no, you didn't.
Not really. Or like, you didn't actually understand what the four forces were. You get an F. Fail.
Right. Because there's really more to it than just the one pager.
Right. Exactly. So this is a great question, because I think I think kind of comes down to like, what are your skills or qualities as a founder? And I know I'm a great integrator of information. And I also know that I am really good at understanding, like, I don't have to be the expert on this. I need to know enough to solve whatever it is that I'm trying to solve, either for a client or for myself or both. And I really don't know. It feels very intuitive. I will also say that it feels like a very intuitive process to me. So for example, with pricing, there is a whole world of how to do pricing. And I remember as we were learning pricing over the last couple of years, I started with what I was learning from Patrick Campbell, for example, an expert, and also doesn't have a course, but has like tons of content. Like, he shares his knowledge very openly about pricing. But then I remember I took a behavioral science course later, and they had a whole section on pricing. And I was like, my mind was blown, because now I'm learning more about this topic. And then I took another course on Reforge, actually. And when I say I take a course, what I'm really saying is I am skimming through this thing like as fast as possible. And I'm really only focusing on the parts that I don't already know. So,
yeah. And like, that's actually a really good tip that you're calling out now is like, there's something to be said for searching for those resources and acting on them and realizing, oh, maybe I need to go back and I need a little bit more of this knowledge, or which sounds like kind of what you're naturally doing.
Yeah. It's also, yes, I think so. I mean, it's interesting because I will say I didn't do this all in one sitting, but I learn enough to unblock me in a particular area. And then that leads me down a path of like, oh, there's more. I mean, it's just like anything, I think, like any natural learning journey. I think I've only ever actively pursued education in an area like once or twice, and where I was like, no, I need to become an expert quickly on this. The only thing about expertise, though, is like you do need experience. Like it's not just like, oh, I've read all the books about OKRs and now I'm the expert in OKRs. It's not right. quite like that, or jobs or whatever it is. Like you do actually have to get experience here.
Apply.
But when I distinctly remember, yeah, like we went through like a job sprint once where I can't remember exactly what the trigger was, but I think I just kind of realized like, you know, actually maybe I don't understand jobs as well as I think I do. And then I learned directly from Bob. Like I like Bob Moesta taught me jobs. Like he really actually taught me jobs. And then I remember. Yes,
very early in the morning, I remember.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my God. It was 5 a.m. It was worth it though. It was, yeah. I was not a human at that time. Kim knows me. She's like, I'm not a morning person.
You're like, I don't do 5 a.m. I'm like, what do you mean? I go for runs at 5 a.m.
Yeah. Oh my
God. You're like, no.
Oh man. But I did it for Bob because it was Bob.
For Bob? You did it.
Yeah, I'd do this for Bob. But yeah, like, to be fair, there's so much of this is intuitive. I think Jobs to Be Done was like maybe like one of the times where I was like, no, I actually do need to learn everything about this right now. And so I remember blocking out my calendar for like a couple of weeks and just going ham on that one thing. But it was a necessary requirement. I don't even remember what we were about to do. I think part of it was we were overhauling our service delivery. And we needed to be more efficient. But I realized in order for us to be more efficient with how we do jobs, I actually need to learn more about jobs because I need to know like what I'm missing. But that was more of like that also kind of felt like a natural process. And I think for founders, though, the hardest part is like, well, how much time do you realistically have? And how much do you actually need to learn the thing, especially if you're not going to do the thing yourself? Like, maybe you're going to either hire the consultant or find the expert. But I think what I'm encouraging is like, yes, like learn a little bit of like learn enough about this to just know that this is solvable. There are people who are experts at this. And instead of like passively just accepting low performance or no growth, like acknowledge and understand like there is a way to solve this. And there's someone right. who knows how to do it.
And other people have done this.
Other people have done this.
You are not alone.
Right. Exactly.
The chance of you being alone in the problem.
Yeah. It's extremely small. Like.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they always talk about like the failure rate of like VC funded startups. But when you think about like the success rate of bootstrap companies, I don't know if that's a stat anywhere, but like I can't imagine it's anything close to what the VC funded number is. So. I would actually imagine that it's probably closer to what just a standard small business is. So like the 20 to 30% failure rate. Like I think that's what it used to be that. It might be different now. And that was back in the day.
Yeah.
But all that to say though, you're either going to learn how to solve the problem yourself because maybe you can't afford to hire someone, or you're going to hire someone. But you need to know that that is a fixable thing.
Right. Yes, we've seen people that are just stuck, but there's no excuse. You can get out of the mud.
Right.
And what you said about hiring someone or getting someone help or not necessarily having to become an expert, right? Because founders are busy with a million things and they're probably not going to be able to take a course, you know, for 3 hours a day or whatever. I think there's something to be said for learning enough so that if you bring on an expert or a consultant, you are starting to know enough about the topic in order to realize, oh, they're doing the work I need them to do, or this seems like that's right? Like you can sort of manage. A lot of founders might be managing help, but they need to understand how to solve the problem at least a little bit first.
Right. Because otherwise they may not have the context for not only like what is actually happening, but what are potentially the trade-offs. And I think any great leader will have at least a general sense of what the trade-offs are within a process. So for example, when we think about pricing, there are so many different ways to tackle pricing and monetization and like optimizing your pricing. There are very simple ways like doing, or I don't want to say simple because it's not actually simple. It's really more straightforward. So there's gathering qualitative and quantitative data like surveys, for example, running what we call a Van Westendorp price sensitivity analysis. Van Westendorp is just a reference to the type of analysis that we're doing. But But there's the Van Westendorp model. There are also processes where you can do more like focus groups and panels. And like, this is more common for like consumer packaged goods, where like people can hold the thing. And then there's like, to me, it's like tier three pricing, which is like, we're going to take all of your transaction data and all of the attributes about that transaction from the customer, from the account, or both. And then we're going to run this like analysis through like a BI that we've built, or like an algorithm that we've built, or we're going to get some mathematician, super nerd guy to like come and like do the number crunching, and we're going to output to you, like, here's what your options are for pricing. And that to me is like the upper echelon. You're going to pay a ton of money for that. And it probably will be the best money spent, but we're talking like minimum 100K to do this project, right? Whereas like on the flip side, you know, you might be able to only spend like 20-25K on a pricing project, or possibly less. It just depends on like what the scope is. But that's the range. And to me, there are trade-offs, right? So if you're a 10 million ARR company, spending 100K on pricing probably is like a no-brainer. You're like, yeah, like if that's going to help me triple or double or whatever it is, let's do it. Let's go for it.
Right.
The trade-off is much clearer, I think, in those scenarios. And also, if you're that large, you probably need a very high fidelity. Like, you need a very high confidence level in what you're about to put out into the world, because you probably have thousands of customers. But if you're smaller or earlier in your journey, you can't afford like the big fancy pricing agency, you probably are okay with a lower fidelity, meaning we're not doing that level of analysis. Like, we don't have to pay someone to do that. Van Westendorp is good enough for us. Like, it gets us further than whatever it was that we were doing before, which is honestly probably just like throwing something together based on what competitors were doing. And that's where most founders start, and they should. Like, it shouldn't be more complicated than that at that stage. But when you're ready to do something with pricing, and like, you know, pricing is a barrier. We had a client that was like this. They had very low net revenue retention. And I distinctly remember being like, it looks like it's actually correlated to all of your pricing changes. And like, and maybe the pricing is not optimized enough for growth. And also because like, you've got very different customer segments trying to buy in different ways. So, So we didn't need a super high fidelity here because we didn't have hundreds of thousands of customers. We just had like, I think 1,000, maybe 2, tons of trialists, but I digress. But I remember like, we didn't need as super high fidelity. We just needed something better than what the founders were doing, which they openly were very much like, listen, like we kind of guess and we play around with stuff every other year or every year. And but it was dramatically impacting overall like long-term retention. Like, they just weren't keeping customers past 8 months, which was very painful for growth. We did a pricing project with them, and then we just heard that for the first time in 2 years, they've had positive growth. Like, they've been flat for 2 years, and now they're seeing, like, with the new pricing, oh my gosh, growth, which is cool.
Right. Now, did they know they had a pricing problem?
No, they didn't.
Just talk me through then, related to what we're talking about.
Yeah, like, how do you
how
know?
Do they? Yeah, so something felt unsolvable. We worked with them.
Yeah.
What's their process look like to try to figure out what to do next?
Yeah, this goes into my overall thesis and approach on how we troubleshoot growth, which probably needs to be its own episode, because there's so many different ways and directions that we can go in. But my approach ultimately was, well, they knew something was wrong. Like, they knew something, like, something is amiss. And, you know, it's hard to deny, like, flat growth. Like, it's flat. You're not growing.
Right.
You are.
That's the problem.
Right, right. We're churning as much as we are gaining, and we're probably not growing or reducing either in either direction. Like, the churn isn't reducing, and also we're not growing the top of the funnel either. So what that usually means is just it's flat. I'm coming in usually, and I'm starting there. I'm trying to understand what's actually the problem and what's happening at a bigger, faster rate. And churn certainly was it actually, if I recall correctly, I think monthly revenue churn actually was pretty healthy, like for that type of business, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
It was actually net revenue retention that was the scarier number. And if you're not familiar with NRR, I actually have an article about this. But if you have ProfitWell, you have this chart in your ProfitWell, you could navigate to it right now as I'm talking. So if you navigate to, I believe it's revenue trends, and then at the bottom in the retention section, there's this little line item that says cohort support. Like I said, if you have ProfitWell and if you have it actually hooked up to your SaaS, like you have net revenue retention actually available to you. If you click that, you're going to get this very large report that's like it's going to show you cohorted retention. So all of the customers that you got 12 months ago, how many of those do you still have? And it's going to do that for every month. And it's going to look like a triangle because 12 months hasn't happened like in this current month. So February 2025, we're not going to know what the 12-month retention is for that because it's only been a month. But 12 months from that month, you'll have, okay, well, what was the cohorted retention of everything that we got? And at the very bottom, there's this line that's called weighted average retained. And that basically just takes the averages for each of the months. And what it tells us is, so for example, what is the average revenue retained for the very first month? You'll have some number. It's probably in the like 80 to 100% range. But when you look down at month 12, that's the number that matters the most, because what that tells us is how much of your revenue do you have to replace every year? And they did not have good net revenue retention. It was like anything less than 80% is going to be challenging growth-wise, because basically you've got to replace 20, what is it? Yeah, you've got to replace like 20% of your revenue every year.
Right.
If you have 50% net revenue retention, you've got to replace half of your revenue every year, which basically like you got to replace either half of your customers or half your revenue or both. And sometimes those are different numbers technically, because you know some customers might be more valuable than others. But this is where this tells me immediately what the health of the business is, like instantly. Like I can tell just by looking at this one chart and I look at nothing else, how healthy is this business?
Right. Because otherwise you're playing catch up.
Right.
You have to make up those people
every year.
Plus every year to stay status quo.
Right. And also, ideally, this is the ideal. And I would say it's probably not even the ideal. It's the bar. Like you have to get here. It's not an option. If you want a healthy SaaS business, you have to get here. You need at least 80% at 12 months, but ideally it's 100 to 120%. And that might sound absolutely bonkers, but what that tells me is you've got not only healthy retention, but also healthy expansion revenue. So customers that you gain are also expanding in value over time.
Hence the over 100%.
Correct. Yeah, because otherwise, if we weren't doing any expansion revenue at all, it would never be over 100%. It'd be closer to just 100. But if we're doing good expansion revenue, it's more than 100. All that to say, so this company in particular, it did not have great NRR. And this is like one of the first things that I look at. From here, ideally we do like NRR is already cohorted, but ideally we then segment further and we say, okay, what's the NRR for certain plans or for certain customer segments or for certain customer types? And then we can start to really get clear on actually who's your best customer. However, most teams and founders don't have this data readily available. So it's either a manual calculation or it's, oh crap, we got to do better with collecting certain pieces of data because we actually have no idea because everyone's just like a Gmail address and we don't actually collect this information about people, which is a whole other problem. So now we have to get more into like you need some, like you've got some data ops work to do because we literally don't know who is your best customer based on like just numbers of who sticks around.
Right.
So when it comes to troubleshooting growth, this is one of the KPIs I look at. To me, it's one of the most critical ones. And there are some who would say net revenue retention actually is less ideal than gross revenue retention. So GRR. GRR is the, I think I want to say that this is actually the number that more VCs look at these days and also like chief level executives. Gross revenue retention is out of all the customers you've ever gotten, how many of those have you retained ever? And it needs to be above 70%, ideally. If it's less than 70%, then it's like you don't have product market fit. But what I think is interesting about that, and this is why I don't use GRR for most founders, is most of them have pivoted And like most of them have completely changed their businesses, especially if they've been around for more than 5 years. And I don't think GRR is fair to look at if you've gone through different iterations of what you've been doing. So,
right. That makes sense.
That's why I don't use that. But just like I'd rather use NRR because it's the snapshot of what is more current. And like in your current iteration of your business, like what does it look like? If I were to use GRR, like it could get sticky pretty fast just because like the customer base that you had maybe before probably just is nothing like what you have now. And that's why GRR to me is like.
Right. And so NRR, is it a rolling 12 months you're looking at?
Usually 12. Sometimes if a company has very healthy NRR, we'll look at 24 months. And that kind of gives me a sense for like, oh, okay, how many stick around for more than 2 years or more than 1 year? But 12-month NRR is what we start with, yeah, for sure. And then once that kind of, you know, once we get that healthy, then it is 24 months. Or sometimes some people will do the stopgap even between that, which I think is what, the 16-month mark or 8? What's the middle point? I can't do math right now. 6, 18, yeah. So the 18-month mark would be like the midpoint. And so for this particular company, they weren't sure, like they knew that they were flat. They weren't sure what was going on. And but they knew enough to know that like we have a problem, which is great. If it were me, like, I mean, obviously if it were me, I would have taken things differently. But I think the natural next step to do is to look at your very basic just performance metrics. So NRR is a big one. If you're not looking at that, you absolutely should be. Doesn't matter what stage you're at in the business, like if you've just launched or if you're like, you know, 5 years in, you should be looking at NRR no matter what, because that is going to give you the healthiest picture of like, is your business healthy or is it not? And then from there, based on what I was seeing, so this report in particular was interesting because we would see some months would have incredible net revenue retention. And then we'd find like some months terrible, like everything is red. And I remember I was asking, I was like, what did you guys do in the months prior to like April and September? Because like those are the worst performing ones. That I'm just like throwing that out there. Like I'm picking that randomly, but it just was really clear. Like they'd have like these spurts of like great net revenue retention, and then like all of a sudden like not good. And then they were like, oh yeah, we launched pricing changes in those times. And I was like, ah,
that's right, yeah.
And I remember that was one of my hypotheses. So now I'm as I'm analyzing a business, I'm developing hypotheses for what the problem could be or like what the root cause could be. And I think that there were a couple of things. It wasn't just pricing. It was also positioning and messaging. It was also who are we actually targeting? Like who's actually the best fit customer? What are the contexts that make them a great customer? It also absolutely was activation and retention. Like the best fit customer wasn't even surviving like the product experience. And I say surviving specifically because that is what it, like you have to think about customers as survivors and not just like they were like these perfect, you know, like, oh yeah, like I understood everything perfectly. No, like they survived your experience. It probably was not super optimized in the best way. Right. And things were probably confusing as hell for them, but they would never tell you that because they don't want to hurt your feelings. Or, and what we've seen a million times in UX research, sometimes people don't even know that they're fighting for their life, which is really funny.
Right. They don't know they're miserable.
Yeah. They like, and they're like, wow, that was so easy. But it's like, ma'am, I literally watched you fight for your life in this UX interview. Like you clicked that button 20 times and it didn't do what you wish you thought it was going to do. You were struggling. But most people don't think about that as struggle. They think about that as normal and they blame themselves. And they're like, oh, I just didn't understand whatever. Anyway, you guys get it. They're like, oh, sorry, I didn't get that. That makes sense now. But it's like, no, like that's an
issue.
Yeah,
that was not your fault.
No, not your fault. Definitely the UX. But yeah, so like they had a couple of challenges, and we really focused on the ones that we felt like were going to have the highest lever. And for me, the highest lever was going to be pricing, it was going to be positioning, messaging, and then activation. And we did, I'm trying to remember now exactly what the project, I know we did a lot pricing wise. And again, they don't have hundreds of thousands of customers. They were less than a million if I recall correctly, less than a million. And stagnant growth for 2 years straight. And I just remember thinking, like, I think pricing is actually what's kind of holding you guys back, in addition to other things. Even like the pricing page, like the experience of it, the data that they were collecting about customers, like when they're users, when they were first joining the product and signing up. And now I want to say like a lot of like they have way more insight now into what actually drives a conversion. But also we came up with, I think we had two or maybe three different scenarios. One that was like good, better, best type pricing, and another that was more like jobs-based pricing or use case-based pricing. And I remember I think they went with good, better, best. And that's actually what was the main like game changer for them. And yeah, we heard that like they're growing for the first time in 2 years, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So they're probably going to be a case study at some point.
Yes. And not an unsolvable problem.
Not an unsolvable problem. Definitely. And I think too, like, yeah, like, you know, we get this question a lot whenever we talk about it with founders because pricing seems so mysterious. And when I first started learning pricing and kind of developing my own practice about it, I remember thinking the same thing. I'm like, this seems so mysterious, but it is so rooted in not just like SaaS pricing methodology, but like it's rooted in commerce, just like anything that you buy.
Exactly.
So right. Like, even if SaaS pricing felt scary, I had to remind myself, like, this is still based on regular ass pricing strategy from regular ass companies. Like, I don't know how else to describe it, but it kind of, sometimes there's cognitive dissonance even within the SaaS world of like, it's almost like we forget, like, no, pricing is ancient.
Right. There's the exchange of money has been happening for a very long time.
Exactly. Right. Capitalism has been alive and well for centuries.
Right. I'll give you this goat for this ear of corn.
Right. Exactly. If only we could trade in corn, that'd be great. But yeah, we probably should do a whole episode just on like how do we think about troubleshooting growth, but that was how we figured it out. And that's not to say that there's ever any one problem. The thing about growth is that it's compounding. Like it's not just one thing. It's not a silver bullet. It's absolutely several things that work together to compound. And NRR is one of those metrics where it's not just one thing. Like you do have to look at everything, and you have to look at everything from who you're targeting to the product that you have to how you're monetizing. And what my mission was like, you guys don't have a healthy business unless we have, you know, at least 80% at 12 months. And to me, it just seemed like, yeah, pricing was the obvious thing to test.
Yeah. And the key there being you also revealed the metric you should be looking at to know when things are going in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. This reminds me of something else I wanted to chat about related to this topic about, okay, so the recap so far is everything is figure outable. Someone else has done it before. There are resources that you can tap. So I think it should be what is natural to you. Like if you're a course taker, take the course. If you are like a super fast reader, if you're a podcast listener, if you're a webinar attender, like do your, like whatever the medium is for you, find the expert or the person who's talking about that thing and like get your knowledge that way. But I think after that, then it becomes a process of now prioritizing a little bit of, okay, like if you know that you have these challenges and if you've accepted that they're solvable and that you should solve them, if you've gone through that, because, you know, a lot of founders don't make it that far, believe it or not. Like,
yeah.
And we've seen this too. Usually people who hire us are like 9.9 times out of 10, like they are committed to making changes. Sometimes we get folks who are not necessarily committed, but if they're having a conversation with us, if they don't move forward, it could very well be a budget thing, but it could also just be they're not quite committed yet to making a change because change is hard, it's scary. But if you've actually gone through the, like just the emotional processing of I am now ready to change something about how I'm doing what I'm doing or what we're doing, then it's about prioritization. And it reminds me of a client that we worked with recently, and I actually developed a prioritization framework for them. And one of the keys to this directly speaks to, do you actually understand the problem? So for context, prioritization frameworks, like you've heard of these a million times before, but like there's like ICE, which is yep. Impact, confidence, and ease. And like whatever the idea is, you score those. So you give it like a 0 out of 5 for impact or like a 0 out of 5 for confidence, et cetera.
Right.
So ICE is a really common one. I see ICE the most because I think that was what was popular, like in the growth hacky type like movement that happened in SaaS.
Yeah.
But I never recommend this for founders. And the reason why is because they have no idea like what impact means or like confidence.
Right.
So it's like, oh, go ahead.
What does it mean?
Yeah. Well, like, so, and yeah, like this is where founders, a lot of founders get stuck because if they've never done something before, if they have no experience with something, then it's like, they don't know how to rank what the impact will be. Like, what is the impact of changing all the buttons to blue?
Yeah, right. We think a 5 out of 5.
Right.
It seems like you're just sort of throwing something at the wall.
I remember we worked with a company once that was using ICE to prioritize growth. This was when I realized, oh, this doesn't work. At least for companies or teams that are either relatively inexperienced or they're just like not like growth experts. But I'll never forget there was a massive debate on if we should change all the buttons to book a demo or if we should just offer a like 3-minute video demo. And I remember the team scored both of these as extremely high of like, yeah, we should do it. It's going to move the needle so much. But then when you looked at like, okay, but which one do you do? Because these are conflicting. and like they literally had like the same score for both. And I just remember thinking like they're under the impression that this one change is going to change it all. But actually the impact is going to be very low, actually. And confidence also is probably really low, but it's really easy. Like it's like a 5 on the ease scale. And they were comparing that with like changing our onboarding experience. And I was like, your highest lever thing is going to be the onboarding. It's actually not going to be changing these buttons. but again, this is kind of where like it was a relatively inexperienced team, which no tea, no shade. But like if you've never done it before, like how do you know? And so the thinking behind ICE is that it's kind of like training your own AI in a way. It's like you're training your own mental model for, oh, well, you rated this as a 5, but it actually didn't have a big impact. So now we've learned. But my thing has always been like, but you'll waste a lot of time trying to figure out, well, what is the impact or the confidence of this?
Yeah. And it feels like maybe for other bigger businesses that are solving different problems all the faster, more, right? A bigger company that might work better for.
Right.
Or an engineering department specifically in a large organization, maybe.
Yeah. Or like a more experienced marketing team or a more experienced growth team or more experienced, like product team, like you mentioned. Yeah. Like right. I think if impact and confidence depends on your experience. Ease is actually pretty easy because you can generally gauge how much work something's going to take. But the caveat here is that you understand it. And that's actually what brings me into this other prioritization framework that I've been using instead that I find has been way easier. So if you are in need of a prioritization framework, Qs is actually what I recommend for folks, especially if you're a first-time founder, especially if you're a technical founder and you're not like a growth expert. So if you've got all these ideas for what to maybe address in your business and you've learned a little bit about like what those things are, Qs to me is an actual next step. So it's confidence, understanding, ease, and speed. So it does still require confidence because I do think it's important to still gauge I do think it's important to at least gauge how confident are you that this will make a difference in the business.
So the confidence level is, will this work?
Right. Will this make a viable difference in the business? And based on the goals of whatever it is that you're thinking about considering, you can adjust confidence accordingly. So it might not. So for example, if you, and this is the context as well, because whatever it is that you're trying to prioritize, like ideally, like you have a sense for, well, what do I think this is actually going to do? Is it going to change MRR completely? Or is it actually going to maybe change the conversion rate of something? Or like, is it going to increase leads? Like, what is that? Like, what is the ultimate goal for what we're thinking of? And then what is my confidence that that is actually true? So you, like, let's say we are considering changing all the buttons to blue. What's our confidence that it is going to make a big impact on revenue? Probably very low, like probably like 0.5 out of 5. But if we change the goal of how confident are we that changing all the buttons to blue will increase the clicks to those buttons? Well, if our buttons were gray before, now they're blue, probably higher, like probably like 3-5 or three. I would say, yeah, the 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5. Like, so the context of your goal obviously matters. And
this feels easier to nail down over impact.
Yes, because impact is like, impact kind of forces you to say, and this is also even where I get stuck, because impact and confidence to me feel so similar.
They're similar, but somehow confidence feels easier because it's your confidence
right.
in it.
It's
as opposed to trying to figure out the impact of something that.
Right. It's a little bit more subjective.
Maybe you don't know. Yes.
And I felt impact is more objective, and you really do have to have like, okay, well, what do we think the impact of this project is going to be on the overall business? And that is also very contextual, but also it depends on more experience of like, well, what does make an impact? I don't know. But if you have more experience, then you have more of a gauge on this. And that's why I think confidence is easier for folks, because it's okay if your confidence is low on something, because the others will help you like better gauge like whether to do it or not. So we have confidence, and then we have understanding. So this is specifically, do I understand what we're trying to do? Like, do I understand the requirements of this project? So for example, if I've identified that pricing is a lever for me to pull, how much do I understand that? And this is why I like this, because if I don't know anything about pricing, then that is a trigger for me to say, I probably need to improve my understanding here. So I probably will go look for articles or webinars or specialists or like whatever and do what I can to understand the scope.
It's basically stopping you and saying, you're not ready to solve this problem yet.
Yes.
You need to make sure your level of understanding is on the higher end.
Right. It shouldn't be 0. It doesn't have to be 5, but like maybe you're developing something and it is a 5. But maybe it's like, okay, I know a little bit about, you know, LinkedIn in-mail messaging. Like I'm like a 2 out of 5, but could I be a 3 or 4 and that make it a little bit better to gauge? So that's kind of where understanding makes something a little bit easier to approach. But it's a stopgap. It forces you to pause and like think about, wait a second, what am I like? This is an idea that I have, but how much do I actually understand it? And therefore prompt the learning cycle, which I think is so important. And it doesn't have to be a deep learning cycle, because again, you don't have to be a 5 out of 5 if you're a 0, but like a 2 is better than nothing, right?
Right.
Then we get to ease. And this actually ease, ironically enough, or pun intended, is easy, I think, for a lot of people to kind of gauge of. Certainly you can overshoot or undershoot, but I think generally speaking, most people have a sense for like, it's intuitively like, how hard is this going to be? Whether it's development or whether it's going to be like a marketing effort. Now, what's cool about this is that it is connected to understanding. So if you understand something better, you'll have a better gauge of how easy it's going to be. And this is why I like understanding so much, because it kind of forces you to get more accurate.
Now, is this saying that something should be easy, or it's okay if it's hard? Is that just helping you decide if you're going to work on it now or later?
Exactly. So things shouldn't have to be easy. And certainly like a lot of product projects are not. It's funny because I feel like every time like a technical project comes up and we're scoring it, especially if it's for growth, every engineer always is going to say like 1 out of 5 on ease. Like this isn't easy. No one ever says, I'll knock that out in like a weekend, like in the morning when I'm eating breakfast. Like everyone's always like, no, this is hard. No, I mean, and that's like no shade. That's just like, it's a common reaction. So yeah, but like, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It just means, okay, we just got to prioritize it maybe differently than something else.
Right. You have to know the level of effort.
Totally. And then speed. So this is my other favorite one. And again, it's correlated to understanding. But speed is all about how fast can we do this? Like how fast can we get this out the door? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like this also is because I think a lot of founders get really stuck on the decision making, which we're going to have an episode all about decision making. So much so it's like to death. Like they get so stuck on every single tiny little thing. And it's really hard for them to kind of cut through the chaff and cut and like see through the noise almost and actually make progress, because again, like it's hard for them to prioritize, but it's also they may not have an accurate understanding of impact. And that's part of why like they it feels like everything is important, but actually there's like only like a few things that are actually important. But you don't know that if you don't have like super deep experience. And I can say this, right, but only purely because I've worked with like over 100 companies by now, which technically, Kim, you have to. but so speed is like, how quickly can we get this done? And again, if you understand it, you can gauge this better. But what I like about this is when founders, even if something is hard, if they feel like, but we could get it done quickly, then it's like, and you're pretty confident it's going to make a like a, you know, a reasonable, measurable impact in some kind of contextual way. Like usually that's actually very exciting to people because SEO, for example, feels very hard if you don't understand it. Once you understand it, it is still fucking hard, but you're probably much faster. Like you're probably able to gain some speed on it. Even though results kind of come a little slower, you can still make momentum on this. Like you can still build and generate momentum in a direction, even if it's hard. Paid acquisition is one of those things where the speed is actually very high, very high. But the understanding is so low.
Right.
The speed and the ease, high. Usually I put like with something like this, I'd put like ease is like a 3 out of 5 because you still have to like do smart stuff. Like you still have to like build good segmentation and targeting and like build good messaging. You still have to build good landing pages. So I'm not going to put it as like the easiest thing in the world, but the speed is usually extremely fast. You can have a campaign up in a matter of hours if you've already got the assets. If you don't, you could probably find someone on Fiverr to turn something around for you in 48 hours. Like you can run like a whole campaign in less than a week. And that to me is ridiculously fast. The confidence usually a little different. And that's kind of where it's like, now do ads make sense for you in your business? Maybe, maybe not. But this is kind of where understanding is important. Cause like if you don't understand what you're doing, obviously like the whole thing can fall apart pretty quickly. But if you have a relative understanding, this is something that can, in theory, happen very quickly. And then it just comes down to budget at the end of the day.
Yeah. And it's such a good way to look at it with this framework because sometimes things feel like too hard to start. But when you really think about it, like if you're talking about paid campaigns and you realize this actually is easy to execute. Like we have someone or we can tap into a resource that knows how to develop this if that founder doesn't know, you know, inside Google Ads, for example. It's like it helps propel you forward.
Totally. And I think there are just so many ideas. And I love when a founder comes to us and they have like a million ideas and they're like, which ones do I do? That's like my favorite because I'm like, oh, cut all these out. Just focus on these like top 5 or top 10. That's my absolute favorite thing. But just speaking from experience of like, you know, how committed are you to moving the needle? Because these might not all be easy. But my understanding of these is very high. So if your understanding of it is low, that's okay. That's why you've hired me,
right?
To some extent, at least. So I can like cut through the chaff very quickly. But what I think is so cool about cues is that if I'm not around, like if I'm not there, you can still use cues because it and you're, like the number will change because as you understand things better, your score might change on that particular thing. And a lot of people ask questions like, should I do 0 out of 5 and then take the average? Or should I like do a sum or a multiplier, like multiply everything? And I recommend people choose what creates the most visual differentiation. Because if you do like a 0 out of 5 and then you take the average of all of those, you're going to end up with numbers that are like 3.46 and like 3.45. And what's the difference between 3.46 and 3.45? Like, what is actually the delta?
Right.
And how much do we care about that delta? So it doesn't give you as much of like an emotional reaction as if you were to do like a sum or even like a multiplier. Multiplier is my favorite because you'll get scores that are like 3,000. But then you'll also get scores that are like 200. And it just makes it a very clear like, oh, like it, and it gives you an emotional reaction. So I recommend do what gives you an emotional reaction to something and not what makes you like almost like scrutinize. If you're scrutinizing the score, then we need to calculate it differently. But if you're more like, oh, this is 8,000. Wow. Like I should do that. Like I'm pulling 8,000 out of my ass. It's probably more like 800 or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know math right now today, but yeah, like it should give you like a visceral reaction. Like it shouldn't be like a, I'm really scrutinizing this and questioning it.
Right. Yeah, that should not be the hard part.
Right. The hard part should be, honestly, sourcing those ideas in the first place and then actually executing them. That's the hard part. But, you know, I say that, but actually, that's the hard part from my perspective. Sometimes the hard part is just knowing, like, what is the actual problem? So to be fair, I think we handle a lot of the hard part, too.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
What did we miss? What did we not cover? We covered a lot.
We did. Yeah. No excuses for saying you can't solve a problem.
Mm-hmm. Someone has figured it out before. There are resources to tap. And when you get ideas, you can prioritize them. Like, it's not just like a free fall. And I think a lot of founders feel like they're in a free fall. And I want people to not feel that way and to feel empowered and enabled to solve problems. Because problem solving is a process. And it, like, no matter what the problem is, there is a process to solve it. Absolutely.
Right. And it's easy to be stuck in your own world of your SaaS company.
Totally.
And of course, especially dealing with technical founders, they're growing, they built their product.
Yeah.
They're creating the thing. They're like, it's like having a newborn.
Yeah.
So I think you're encouraging founders to remember, like, you can step outside of that. Look at the past companies. There's resources out there, and you can kind of think, you can take a step back.
Totally.
Outside of the business, you know, and look at it that way.
Totally. And I get, like, it's hard to see when you're working in it. But part of the transition that needs to happen is that you're working on the business and not always so in it. But to be fair, when you're super early stage, you're in it. Like, you just are. But when you get to a place of growth where you have room to actually think about, okay, how are we going to steer this ship? Where are we going? And what are my best levers for growth? And yeah, that's kind of where we get into some of this work. This makes me feel like we need episodes specifically on what is our process for pricing? What is our process for activation? How do we think about acquisition, and how do we think about expansion and things like that? But, and also like product discovery. But yeah, how do we find new product opportunities? Like, what do we prioritize?
Yes. Ooh, I like those.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. We got to add that to the list. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you, Asia. Talk soon.